The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm joined today by my colleague Katie Balls, the Spectator's deputy political editor. Now, Katie, today is the 5-year anniversary of the Brexit referendum. It does seem sometimes like more than 5 years ago. How do you think it's changed British politics?
Well, I think it's changed who the Prime Minister is, for one, several
Twice.
Times. It's obviously impacted, I think, how we see through everything. We just had a pandemic by which it meant we stopped bickering about Brexit. And also, in a way, the debate was over because we finally got to the point where we had left the EU. But I think if you think back over the past 5 years, it does feel as though our politics has been dominated by that issue. First, in terms of David Cameron's departure, then the arrival of Theresa May. And I think what dominated her entire premiership was the question of Brexit, not helped by her decision to call the snap election, and the divides it created in the Tory party, and then Boris Johnson, now the Tory leader and the Prime Minister. And the Conservative Party is in a much better place. Just look at the polls where they are very far ahead. But I think it's also led to a different type of Tory party. We have a situation where the makeup of the Tory party now is full of, you know, former Labour heartlands that voted heavily to leave. And you now have a situation where you look at the Chesham and Amersham by-election, which doesn't seem to be specifically to do with Brexit. But I also don't think it's unreasonable to make the point that when David Cameron was Prime Minister, a lot of these constituencies seemed a lot safer than they do now. And there has been a shift in that sense. James, what do you think the changes have been?
I think you're right about the ways in which it's kind of realigned British politics. I think that, you know, if you had said to someone before the Brexit referendum that there would be two by-elections close together and the Tories would win Hartlepool but lose Chesham and Amersham, they'd have looked at you very strangely. Now, some of these factors were beginning to play in before Brexit. You know, HS2 was not popular in Chesham and Amersham before the by-election there. The prospect of planning reform was not popular. In Hartlepool, there was a sense, you know, that the seat was not as Labour as it had once been. You know, you saw in the election of Angus and Monkey how well UKIP had done in some of these places, that there was a sense of alienation from Labour. But Brexit has undoubtedly catalysed these political shifts and created something of a domestic realignment. I think the interesting question now is who wants to carry on talking about Brexit? I think you can clearly tell that Boris Johnson does. You know, look at the message he sent out this morning to mark 5 years from the referendum, keen to talk about it in PMQs. And I essentially think that that he is happy with a trade where the Tory party, you know, he is happy to live with whatever attrition there might be on the Tory vote in certain places by carrying on talking about Brexit, because he thinks the political benefits are greater. Keir Starmer, I think, is the opposite. I think Keir Starmer really just does not want to talk about Brexit. I think he thinks, despite himself being a Remainer, despite sitting for a very heavily Remain seat, I think he thinks that Labour need to kind of neutralise Brexit as a political issue to have a route back to power. So I think there is an asymmetry in British politics now about who wants to keep talking about it and who doesn't.
I suppose in terms of the ramifications of the consequences of that vote that we're still seeing today, the greatest is the union. Now, there's the issue of Scotland, where there's some talk of an independence referendum. It's probably calmed down slightly since the Scottish Parliament elections, where the SNP fell short of a majority. But you also can see it in Northern Ireland, I think most primarily the protocol. But there has been some good news in that today, hasn't there, James?
Yeah, it looks like the EU are going to grant the UK a kind of 6-month extension on chilled meats, otherwise, in other words, sausages. Sefcovic, the EU Commission Vice President, who's dealing with this issue, has kind of said to member states, let's agree this and agree this quickly, arguing that would be helpful before the marching season in Northern Ireland. I don't think this means that all the problems with the protocol and the tensions between the UK and the EU have been solved. But I think what it is indicative of is a desire slightly on both sides to tone things down. So you had the UK deciding to request an extension rather than unilaterally grant themselves one, and then the EU move to show that, you know, oh, you've requested an extension. I'm sure, you know, having previously some of the rhetoric suggested this wouldn't be possible, to kind of very quickly move to formalise that request. And I think, you know, I think the question is, can they get to a modus vivendi on the protocol? Can they find a way where both sides can be satisfied on the protocol? Because I think until you do that, you know, there might be other reasons why, but until you do that, it is pretty much guaranteed that UK-EU relations will remain quite scratchy. I think this is one of the interesting questions, is whether the scratchiness we have seen in post-Brexit relations between the UK and the EU is something that is going to continue for years to come, or whether the two sides can remember their kind of shared geopolitical interests and the fact that, you know, ultimately both of them succeeding is good for the other. I think you have to get away from this idea that one has to fail for the other to succeed. I don't think that's right. And on that point, I thought it was interesting. You had a kind of reminder today of these tensions, with this whole issue of the Russians claiming, disputed by the British government, that they fired on a UK warship that was sailing off the Crimean Peninsula, territory that Russia has claims it's his, claims it belongs to it, but a claim that is not accepted by other countries. And I think there's an interesting question here, which is, you know, that UK action, I mean, is a reminder of the extent to which the UK, contrary to some of the predictions, still plays this very active role in European security and defence. And I think it's a question as to whether that and their kind of shared interests that you saw talked about at the G7, whether those issues can overcome this scratchiness. Now, I mean, you saw that tension at the G7 summit, which is, did they want to have a fight with each other over the protocol, or did they want to talk about the kind of Western alliance and these loftier ambitions or not? And I think that the way that tension plays out is going to be fascinating, Kate.
And James, you mentioned earlier how Boris Johnson does want to talk about Brexit. We've seen evidence of that today. Do you think Brexit's still going to be a message by the time of the next election? In a way, you can see the benefit of the Tories, because it's what helped break down those areas that have been Labour for so long. But if it does feel as though the issue is closed...
I think if Keir Starmer is still the leader of the Labour Party, the Tories will try and use that as a message, as in a kind of, he's not on your side. You know, it'll be a kind of bloody shirt. Don't forget, he tried to kind of, they will claim, he tried to kind of cancel your vote by having a second referendum. All of that kind of stuff, I think, will... So there'll be that kind of cultural element of the argument. I think, but, you know, and also I think the government will be very keen to argue that it has been able to do certain things because of Brexit. You know, you see their keenness to say that, you know, everything from stopping the European Super League to the vaccine rollout have been benefits of Brexit. I think you will see the government frame lots of things in that context, in part because they know that Labour really don't want to get into those arguments.
And another news, James. One of the things dominating the news today is when Freedom Day, as it's come to be known, is going to occur. And we have a situation where there's lots of positive talk again about the 19th of July, but I think lots of listeners will remember when there was positive talk about the 21st of June. But this time, do you think it's a real deal?
Yeah, I think the costs of delaying again are far greater for government in terms of, you know, both politically and economically. I think the last 4-week delay has not had, obviously for some individual businesses that has been terrible, but
some individuals.
But at the macroeconomic level, the consequences have not been dire. I think if you got another delay, that would really dent confidence about whether you would ever get to a kind of full reopening. I also think the data continues to look good is not the right phrase, because you still got cases rising, but the speed with which cases are rising is slowing down. You're still suggesting that if the link between cases, hospitalizations and deaths is not broken, it is at the very least very severely weakened. And I mean, all of these things are giving you more confidence about going ahead. I don't think this 2-week, I don't think the restrictions are going to be lifted at this 2-week review point. But I think when the 4-week point comes, I think the restrictions will, the numbers on limits on numbers will go, and the 1 meter rule will go. And that'll be a huge relief to pubs and restaurants, because they will once more be able, therefore, to operate at full capacity.
What about travel? Because there's some reports now that ministers, including Rishi Sunak, including Grant Shapps, are pushing for travel to be eased also on the 19th of July. So there's no such thing almost as an amber list for those who are double vaccinated, all their children.
I think what we are most likely looking at is people who've been double vaccinated would not have to self-isolate on return from amber list countries. Instead, they would have to be tested daily. As you said, their children would be exempt. I suspect the likely date for the start of this scheme is the end of next month rather than the 19th of July, rather than it all happening on one big bang day, a little slight delay. In part, I think this is because there are real concerns about, you know, how do you keep flow of people going in airports with all the extra COVID paperwork? Because you'd have to have a way of checking, when you go to board your flight, that checking your vaccination status, that you are double jabbed and the like. So I think that will be complicated. I also think this is an interesting beginning of a debate here, because what we are seeing in both the proposal about travel and in the proposal about self-isolation is the government essentially saying that they will treat double vaccinated people differently to the rest of the population. And I think that how far that policy goes could become a very interesting debate in the coming months.
And with that, I'm just bringing an editor for one final question, because you looked slightly alarmed when James was talking.
Yeah, I'm deeply uncomfortable with the notion of immunoprivilege. And I think I think what James says is a practical solution. The Americans have been doing this for a while. But what slightly unnerves me more is the idea of barring access to football grounds, for example, to those who haven't had the double jab. We know that the ethnic disparities are absolutely huge. I think 5% of whites haven't had the vaccine versus 32% of blacks. So let's be under no doubt as over who might potentially be discriminated against by any mechanism which gives the vaccinated privilege. The other strange thing about the amber list countries is when we drew up these amber and red lists, Britain had the lowest COVID levels in Europe. So it was argued, quite logically, that if you go abroad to one of the higher COVID countries, there's a higher chance you might come back with the virus, and we've got to be careful. Now, if you look at the Spectator Data Hub, Britain has now, by some margin, the highest COVID levels in Europe. There aren't that many countries really with more COVID than we've got. So it's not clear to me why, if you jet off to Spain or France or Italy, the government thinks you're any more likely to come back with COVID than if you go to Birmingham, Manchester or Hackney. And so you get the mechanism designed for one era, which is probably outdated with another. So I think we have to keep a careful eye on this kind of thing, because we are about to hit a period, I suspect, of very high cases. Still at the moment, hospitalizations are about half of what Sage said they would be. So we ought to be thinking about deliberalizing now and going a lot easier, including on test and trace, instead of thinking of ways of rebooting a testing regime and indeed a sort of internment regime, which was designed for another period altogether.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.